evening in our joint celebration of Raquel Rolnick's astounding new book, Urban Warfare, Housing Under the Empire of Finance. It is absolutely terrific to see so many students in the room, and I'm also sensing that this is a room that has an awful lot to say, and there will be plenty of space for you within the arrangements of tonight for you to have that say. My name is Susie Hall, and together with my colleague David Madden, I co-direct the Cities Program in the Department of Sociology at the LSE. I'm especially pleased to welcome and introduce our panel of academics and activists, including Professor Raquel Rolnick, Dr. Glyn Robbins on the far end, and Dr. David Madden in the middle. Raquel Rolnick is Professor of Urbanism at the University of Sao Paulo, and across her critical and courageous set of practices, she has worn multiple hats. So it's quite an amazing biography here. These include Director of the Planning Department of the City of Sao Paulo, National Secretary for Urban Programs of the Brazilian Ministry of Cities, and the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing. And you would imagine within some of these conservative formats that there wouldn't be much room for courage, but you've seemed to have found it and used it to great effect. Glyn Robbins, who has taught with us this year, we've had the pleasure of working together, is a longtime housing worker, an activist with Axe the Housing Act, and is the author of There's No Place, The American Housing Crisis and What It Means for the UK. And David Madden, my colleague, is Associate Professor of Sociology and Co-Director of the Cities Program, and also author of the acclaimed book, together with Peter Marcuse, In Defense of Housing. So the way we're going to run it tonight is that Professor Rolnick is going to talk for around 40 minutes, and then we'll have two sets of respondents, starting with Glyn Robbins and then moving on to David. They'll each talk for around 10 to 15 minutes. And then we will open the discussions to the floor. I should advise you that the event will be recorded tonight and available subsequently on podcast. For the Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Urban Warfare. I would ask you now to make sure that all your phones are on silent and join me in welcoming Professor Rolnick to speak. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. I would like, first of all, to thank a lot to LSE, Sociology Department, to Susie, and especially to David Madden, who was truly the responsible of inviting us all here. And also, thank you for you for coming tonight. And I am here, as you know, to share with you my newest book, Urban Warfare, Housing Under the Empire of Finance. The book is there. And because the book is there, of course, I won't tell everything that is in the book, because, of course, I want you to buy it, and it's not expensive at all. It's just $19.99. But the book was the result of my work as rapporteur, special rapporteur, on the right to adequate housing, in which a mission here we call the mandate of a special rapporteur, the visits to different countries, they call missions. A mission here in the UK in 2003 was a very important chapter of my mandate, especially hearing the ones most affected by housing policies reform as part of austerity measures that were taken and still are being taken here in this country, dismantling the welfare state. And by that time, in 2013, maybe some of you can remember that, contrary to what the British Tories believed my visit to the UK was not motivated politically by Labour or opposition parties, not at all, but it was motivated by a research hypothesis, which is a large-scale narrative about a current global process. And what is this global process? Is the radical transformation of the direction of housing policies worldwide and its failure as an alternative to the provision to adequate housing for all. And I'm talking about the paradigm shift from housing as a social policy, as a human right, as part of the welfare system, as part of the pact society does in order to share some of the wealth produced by the society into financialization of housing, into housing in specifically, but also built space in general, as a financial asset. So we are talking about a new colonial empire, which is faceless and flagless, which is seizing our territories and reshaping our cities. And this new colonial empire, and I use empire, colonial empire in purpose, because it's a question of occupation territories, but also changing cultures and imposing cultures and ways of life and ways of organizing life. It's a global process which is deterritorialized, abstract, fiction, speculative, because finance is speculative by nature, is the game of betting in future that nobody knows what's going to happen, in which space, especially built space, has a very important and key role. It's a global process, but like all the other real experiences of colonialism, each locality has a particular unique expression, depending on path-dependent political economies of land and housing. So it's global. We are talking about something that is everywhere, but also it's unique. Unique regionally, unique in different countries, unique in different cities, as we clearly see here in the UK, most acute in London, outrageous in London, maybe less so in other parts of the country. We could talk about this global process by several ways. We can refer to rent-seeking landscapes, shopping malls, corporate towers, international brands, hotels, cultural centers, which reproduce themselves in different cities, offering to the surplus of capital which circulates over the planet this electronic cloud, this wall of money, of financial fluxes. They offer real estate homogeneous products all over, which can be priced in international markets. That explains, for instance, how come we are in different places like Jakarta, Astana, Rio, or Chicago, and we see the same landscape. It's not a lack of imagination of architects. It's much more than that. We are talking about specific products priced internationally, which serve basically for those rent-seeking financial fluxes. But we won't talk about those type of products here. Here, we want to talk about this process, the taking over of the built space by financial capital and in its impact through the lenses of housing policies, which of course has a lot to do also with urban policies, which actively created the material, symbolic, and normative conditions for the capture of lived territories and generating a global process of dispossession. But we also want to interrogate who and where are the dispossessed and displaced and their forms and tactics of emplacements facing those displacements. So, of course, we need to talk about resistance, insurgents, but also other ways of building space all over the world. Through my mandate of special rapporteur, which was from 2008 to 2014, I could witness the effects of the financial crisis which sparked in 2007-2008. So what were those signs of the financial crisis? Foreclosures, very clearly in some places like Ireland, like the US, like the Spain, and raising homelessness in many countries. I was doing a mission in the United States, and I couldn't witness people living in their cars in several states because they were just out of their foreclosed homes and they had no other place to go. But also, I arrived in Kazakhstan in 2009 as a rapporteur, and surprised, there was a hunger strike of people that had put all their savings into buying homes that were promoted clearly by the government as the solution to have housing. And because of the financial crisis, those developers, mainly Turkish developers, that were able to promote residential property through financing from Europe, especially Germany, with the financial crisis, were just collapsed, bankrupt, and they were not able to finish the buildings and the apartments, and the people were simply in the middle of the streets without their savings and without an apartment to live. I could also witness in a mission in Tel Aviv where, coming from the human rights system, was supposed to focus mainly on Palestine and Israel, but all of a sudden there was a massive camping in the middle of Dizengoff Street of youth claiming for adequate housing, Israeli youth, because the whole system of housing welfare was being dismantled as well. And again, when I arrive in here, movements anti the bedroom tax were on the rise. So what happened in all those places? And especially, we were talking about the US, the UK. We are talking about countries that in the late 70s, I would say, were not witnessing a housing crisis. The countries that in their times were able to provide adequate housing, not for all, never, but at least for the majority of the working class. So what happened with those countries? all of this sudden. So what happened was a state-led process of dismantling housing as a social policy, as part of the dismantling of welfare state, as a human right, into transforming housing as a commodity and a financial asset, a place where to park wealth and then to be part of a financial system, to act as a collateral in order to finance consumption, to finance old age, because at the same time, pension funds, state pension funds, and all the whole systems were also privatized and changed as well. So we were witnessing also a race in a housing policy, and you can see that very clearly in a World Bank booklet saying housing enabling markets to work, which is the main mantra, which is still the discourse here, amazing, saying let the market work and build houses and then everybody will get home ownership through credit. And this is absolutely a lie, because if we see in the reality, and part of the dismantling of the social policy was to push everybody into indebtedness, to push everybody into enter into the credit system, and the subprime crisis in the U.S. was clearly having for very low income and the most vulnerable any other way of accessing housing, because public housing was not available anymore, and other aids to housing not available anymore. So the only solution, the only way, was to get a credit and to enter into indebtedness, generating for the whole society a push towards depreciation of value of housing, because it is depreciation of value of the housing that permits for the families and for the households to get more money out of the housing, using the housing as a collateral. So housing became an ATM machine. An ATM machine in a moment, and we are talking about neoliberalism, where wages were going down, where registered work and not precarious work was going down as well. So desperately, the idea of making money is making money out of property. But, of course, the strategy to do that, and it was very different in the different cases. In the case of UK, also it was the case of Eastern Europe and most of the former communist countries, was privatizing the housing stock. So it's amazing how in the late 70s, here, almost 40% of all the residential stock in the country was social housing. And then, after Margaret Thatcher reforms and right to buy, which was absolutely essential politically in order for the Conservatives to get its constituencies within the working class, because right to buy to city tenants with great discounts. So for those who were living as tenants, was just the miracle. All of the sudden, I was living in the house, in the same house, I was not evicted, and it was mine. And that was perfect in the first years, but the very small problem is that people continue to live. And then the next generation, you basically, have not the opportunity to have social housing anymore, because not only they were either demolished or privatized, but more important than that, all the subsidies that used to go to social housing to promote more for councils, but also for housing associations, for cooperatives, for the different arrangements that existed and still exist here, they were shifted towards subsidies to home ownership, and especially to middle and high income families through tax exemptions, which is exactly what happened also in the US, where a dual system, credit for home ownership, which was the responsible of building all the suburbs from the 30s, 40s on, was there, but also another parallel, very important policy of building housing projects in the cities for the working class that also was terminated under Reagan, was demolished and stigmatized, residualized. So that's why I'm talking about a cultural phenomenon as well. Because if you live in a social housing, you are a failure. And if you are a good person, a nice person, you're going to be a homeowner, you're going to have credit, and all the rest are the losers. And social housing became the place for the losers. So the stigmatization of the whole machinery of providing social housing was a very important part of it. Also, in some countries, it was not the case of privatization of the stock, or very important part of the stock, but also it was the financialization of housing promoters, which also is true here for the housing associations. But it was very clear, for instance, in the Netherlands, where housing associations were obliged to get credit in the market in order to finance themselves, and then because of the interest that they have to pay, they have to charge much more for their tenants. But also, we have different versions of the same financialization if we are talking about some cities in the so-called Global South. I won't get into discussion about this term. We agree Global South is not a good definition. But anyway, there is also financialization in countries where you said it was not a question of dismantling a housing as part of the welfare system, because this welfare system never existed, but at least existed as a utopia or a desire. And what we had was basically, and still have, self-built housing by the people themselves. The version of financialization, which is a different version, another version of financialization of housing in those cases, was to subsidize low-income people who used to live in self-built settlements to buy something that was produced by private developers. So basically, the program My House, My Life in Brazil is one of the examples of this type of program, where the government gives you money so you can use this money to buy this private product, with just a very small question in it, which is, since private developers have to provide houses at a cap price, a maximum price, the only way private developers can have a lot of profit is if they buy very cheap land. And very cheap land in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, means non-urbanized land. Land without city, without services, without infrastructure in the outskirts. So the result of this financialization was massive production of housing in the outskirts, in the peripheries of cities without being adequate. And the laboratory for this model, which is the second big version of financialization, which is not mortgage, it's a different model, was Chile under Pinochet. Chile under Pinochet set the model that then was copied by Mexico, by Brazil, by South Africa, and other countries as well. But also, this was a way, and this is important to see the relationship between housing policies, financialization of housing policies, and financialization of urban, because that was a way, very clearly in the case of Chile, of Mexico, and Brazil as well, to an instrument to evict informal settlements from very well-located locations. This was true also for the housing projects in the U.S. The ones that were demolished were not the public housing, which is in the outskirts in a very bad condition, but very well-located, because the mantra of urban policies under neoliberalism is unlock land value, which is another title of another World Bank booklet to teach countries how to reform their urban policies, say how come this prime location can be used or lived by these very low-income people. So you must get rid of them, and no problem, you displace them, so that's a machinery of displacement, towards the suburbs, the periphery, very far away, and then you have this prime land to offer to the highest bidder. And the highest bidder could be the Russian plutocrat, could be the oil sheikh, could be the sovereign fund of some Gulf state, could be the sovereign fund of Germany, who knows, could be a pension fund, could be a investment fund which includes our savings, which collecting all the savings of everybody can compete with us, poor guys, for the location. So guess who's going to win for this competition. So we are talking about a process of geographic restructuring, of expansion of borders, which has a very different and intense speed, because now all the moving out of financial capital is through electronic bits. And it's not, and of course, we know how much capital creates and destroys built space as part of its process of circulation and reproduction, spatial fix. Harvey, the notion that David Harvey explains very well. But now we are talking about a completely different scale. First, because one of the main characteristics of this neoliberal era is that countries don't pose and should not pose any barrier to the movements of capital, which is absolutely not true in regard to the movement of people. I had to stay 2 hours in the border when I arrived on Saturday to check my papers. And when I finally arrived there, I said, "Oh, you Brazilian, what are you doing here?" "Oh, I will present a book." "And what is the subject of the book?" "Oh, it's on the housing crisis." "Housing crisis? Oh, welcome." You can't believe what my family is living through. We are living, and then he started to talk about, and that's it. So what this massive amount of capital, so we are talking about a new scale, because it's a transnational scale, including offshore, that have no connections with the country, don't pay any taxes to circulate and pass over, and that type of capital is has a very important relationship with property, with the built space, through the process of titularization. So what is titularization? It's the fact that capital can come and go into buildings and land without really selling the whole thing. So with a piece of paper, with a digital bit that represents value, capital can come on and out very easily, and the place continues there. So that was absolutely impossible to happen without the active role of the states, which removed any barrier to the circulation of capital, but also made all the efforts, for instance, make you rent less protected, contract, 6 months contracts of rent, so absolutely removing, at the same time, destroying all the attachments and all the fixity of people in their places, removing that, making there much more ridiculous and weak, and at the same time able for the capital to come and go. And this is particularly important in the cases of, again, Global South cities, where all type of land reforms were done in order to implement regimes of private property and only property, making all the bonds and the tenure systems that existed before residual, not important, not able to persist, because, of course, all of these bonds represented a way of holding on land and not being able to circulate. And, of course, private property is not the safest of all kinds of tenure, as we have seen so clearly with foreclosures. Private property is the one which is most free to circulate. So that's the point. This is just the first part of the book and the beginning of the second part. So there is a whole part of the book showing that how much planning also was very essential on setting the borders between what part of the cities should be respected as places and what part of the cities would be absolutely neglected. And we are talking about how much all sorts of organizing space, which is not equal to the colonized way of organizing cities, which is absolutely based on property, including public land, private land. Public land, first, is what is not private. Second, public is seen as the private property of the state. So that permits, for instance, the state to sell, to do whatever the state wants with its property and not as common property. And those ways of organizing property and cities, facing favelas, bastis, kampung, slums, this is specialty marked by the logic of life, not only as mark them as illegal, informal. How come they are informal, have no form? So not only illegal, informal, but also in this very discriminatory gestalt, making them seen as criminal or something that is related to a logic of disorder, creating that in those places a true state of exception. A gray space like Oren Yiftachel, who is here, has denominated, which is not destroying those places in terms of, well, if they are illegal, why not all the favela residents are on jail if they are illegal, if they are offenders? Because the thing is not being legal or illegal, but the thing is the ambiguity that permits at the same time those territories to provide space for life for most of the people, but also at the same time permits that when a new expansion of the real estate financial complex needs that place, it's the easiest place to get rid of, since it's illegal, since should not be there. So we have thousands of examples in the book showing how much how this happened. And finally, we have a whole account in the book on how much this happened, how financialization of housing and land happened in Brazil during the Workers' Party administration, which a administration with a very anti-neoliberal speech and discourse and position, and you have to buy the book in order to know how come that happened. But more than that, we also, in this edition, made a afterword, because the whole hypothesis of the book was on home ownership and how home ownership became the one and only policy that should be presented, and all the countries should reform their policies towards this model. But now we have a new wave of housing financialization, which is not related to home ownership, but it's related to rent. And this process is through global corporate landlords that bought the devaluated stock of foreclosed homes and empty homes after the burst of the bubble and the financial crisis, and became huge landlords of, in some countries like the United States, one investment fund like Blackstone have almost 100,000 homes to rent, and became a monopolistic agent in the market of rent. And again and again, we have different versions of this new wave of financialization. Global corporate landlords is one, but also we have Airbnb as one of the faces of rent as well. So finally, we are talking clearly about the urban warfare. An urban warfare in which space is more than an inert scenery where the battles take place, but the space being the object of the battles itself. So all that we are witnessing now in many different places of the world, tenants' union, organization of homeless, squatting, organized squatting in many, many countries in order to create and affirm the idea of housing as a right and housing as a place to go, they are battles around appropriation and occupation of space. And it's basically the political confrontation, which I think are very crucial today for the future of our cities, between territories understood as landscapes for life or territories understood as playground for financial capital, uprooted and disconnected from the dwellers' needs and desires. Thank you.
Evening, everyone. Thanks very much for the invite. It's good to see you again, Raquel. I last met Raquel during the visit that she referred to back in 2013, and she made quite an impact. Her criticisms of the bedroom tax made front page news and really, really annoyed the government. And it was a pleasure to be associated with that. And if Raquel was here for much longer, we'd definitely want to find out what she thinks about universal credit, which is effectively the new iteration of the bedroom tax. Mm-hmm. But as well as being in the centre of media storm, as she was, and I was behind the scenes, the fond memories that I have of that visit were also of somebody of status, someone with Raquel's credibility, if you will, that rare occasion when someone of that persona speaks up for people who are at the sharp end of austerity. How often does that happen? And it was certainly something that people who I'm involved with as a campaigner were genuinely appreciative of, that this was somebody who was not only listening to us, but was speaking for us. And that's reflected also in Raquel's book. And you can read whole volumes of urban sociology and never know that there are campaigns of resistance and opposition and people fighting back. But in Raquel's book, you only have to wait until the second paragraph. But the truth of the matter is that in those intervening 6 years, things have got worse. Not just in this country, but globally. The property juggernaut, the private speculator, the casino, however we want to refer to it, has actually gained strength. And in some respects, the opposition to it has weakened, and as a result, the housing crisis has deepened. And in a way, the ultimate personification of that, and again, this has happened since Raquel was here, was the election of a property speculator and slumlord as the President of the United States. Which in a way I think is in all the many things that can be said about number 45, the fact that that is how he made his fortune, or at least increased it, is often overlooked. And I think it's something we should be very mindful of as a warning, as a sign of where we've got to. But in some ways, I'm thinking more locally, an equal symbol of the state of what we've come to is the spectre of Grenfell Tower, which still should haunt every single discussion that we have about housing and urban policy, not just in this country, but across the world, because what happened at Grenfell could and indeed does happen everywhere. But I think Raquel's book shows that the speculative machine is a global phenomenon. It's global in scale, but as Raquel has said, it is local in impact, and it plays out day to day, as she describes, the predomination of private property over other forms of tenure, all other forms of tenure, is something that is experienced as the day-to-day life of working class communities like the one that I work for and in, which is very near to Old Street Roundabout. Some of you may know it. You may not know it by the brand that some people want to affix to it, Silicon Roundabout or Tech City, as they want us to think of it, but actually what the area around Old Street is, and is a working class community, lots of council estates, which of course the aforementioned citizens of Tech City would like to get their greedy hands on, and we're not going to let them have it. And it was a pleasure to show Raquel around the estate when she was over here. And to continue the military metaphor, the estate's called Quaker Court, is currently under siege. And the stable, intergenerational, but actually very culturally diverse working class community that has been living there for many, many years, is under threat to the point where the people who have been living there all of that time and their children no longer feel that they have a place there or that they have a future there. And this plays out in all kinds of different ways, and I could talk about it for longer than we have this evening. But just quickly, and so many of these details are reflected in Raquel's earlier comments. So at a very, I suppose, prosaic level almost, the constant disruption of multiple building sites. The estate is literally surrounded on all sides now by building sites. And so one of my daily tasks is talking to some of these developers, their managing agents, and a very basic demand. We're not talking about nationalising the top 200 industries here. We're saying keep the noise down. This is a residential area. But they are, of course, oblivious to that because they are driven by profit and the need to get the job done. And we understand that to an extent. But this is the daily reality of people who I work for. And it also plays out in the separation of families and the inability of children of those families to afford to live in the home or in the community in which they've been brought up. Again, multiple reasons for that, but the main one, and we need to be absolutely clear about this, and Raquel has referred to it, the main one is the historic underinvestment in council housing. And when I talk about council housing, I mean real council housing. There's a lot of fake council housing going around at the moment. I mean housing that is owned by the local municipality, where people have permanent, secure tenancies and a genuinely affordable rent and a landlord that they can evict every 4 years during an election. That's what real council housing is. And actually, that is the only way we are going to get out of the housing crisis in this country, is by a national programme of council house building and investment. But that displacement effect weakens the social and support networks that are critical to communities like the one where I work. And of course, another feature of that is the exponential rise of private renting, and that happens on the estate as well. Approximately a third of the people who live on the estate are now private renters. They are super exploited themselves, most of them, never more than 2 months away from an eviction notice. And actually, hand in hand with investment in council housing, we need to demand improved conditions and security of tenure and fair rents for private renters. But the other aspect to this, of course, is a transience, a churn, an instability of the community, which is in some ways difficult to identify. It doesn't boil down to a neat equation, but it's a feeling that you get. And we think that around 30% of the estate changes every year. People don't know each other. How can we ever hope to build that kind of holy grail of policy that we've had for many years of mixed and coherent and stable communities if people don't know their neighbours? But they don't know their neighbours anymore. And part of the reason for that is the churn caused by private renting. So we get the undermining of community cohesion, atomisation, and also a kind of cultural alienation, which again Raquel alluded to. And again, it's difficult sometimes to illustrate this, but I think of it in terms of how the area has changed in terms of the shops that are available to local working class people. And to give one specific example, they have lost Superdrug, but very soon CNN will be moving in to the immediate area, into an office immediately opposite Quaker Court. And actually, again, thinking back to what Raquel was talking about, we are commonly now finding people sleeping in the bin chambers of the estate. Only this week, in fact, we found somebody who had changed the locks onto a bin chamber and is sleeping in there every night. And almost every day at work, I have people come in and speaking to me about these sorts of things, and they say, this is making us sick. Bad housing makes us sick, which is the title of the campaign event which I'm helping to organise this coming Saturday, which Raquel has very kindly offered to open. There's some literature about it at the back of the room. And we're going to be talking about this, and it's something that is often overlooked and neglected, how bad housing is making people sick in all sorts of ways. So if you'd like to come along on Saturday, either talk to me afterwards or pick up a leaflet at the end. But Islington is also the place where the resistance against the 2016 Housing and Planning Act took seed. And if you think things are bad now, if the Housing and Planning Act had come into force in the way that the Tory government hoped it would, they would be getting a lot worse. But actually, we built a united national campaign against the Housing and Planning Act, and we have rendered it essentially a dead letter, or at least to a large extent. Now, the threat still remains, and that's why we say that piece of legislation has to be repealed. But the threat returns in other guises. And there's a new threat on the horizon, I suppose, and it's coming from people who we might think of perhaps as our allies. There's a new kind of phenomenon, really, which is of progressive politicians who are claiming to address the housing crisis, and I don't question their sincerity in attempting to do that, but they're using policy tools and language which actually run the real risk of making the situation worse. And I talked earlier about fake council housing. I'm thinking about Bill de Blasio in New York City, and I'm thinking about Sadiq Khan here in London. And Sadiq Khan has talked about building 11,000 council homes, and some of them are in Islington, but actually the rents for these new council homes are at least a third or more expensive than those for existing council housing. And one of the parts of the Housing and Planning Act that we campaigned against was so-called pay to stay, you may recall. And the government dropped pay to stay under pressure, but actually it's coming back. Pay to stay 2.0 is being sponsored by Sadiq Khan and other progressive or so-called progressive politicians who still don't seem to have learnt the lesson that the market is the cause of the problem, not the solution to it. And that is something that we have to change as well. So we are at a crossroads, I feel. I think we are at a critical moment, although I've been saying this for numbers of years, but the critical moment seems to be going on longer than I thought it would. In one direction, and it's an allusion to the book that Susie referred to that I wrote about America, and the warning that I think America sounds to us in the UK and elsewhere about the direction of policy, and we only need to think about number 45 if we're in any doubt about that. So the unvarnished brutality, and it is brutality, of the housing system in America is one that I think that there are politicians in this country who want to introduce into this country. And again, Raquel has described how they may go about that. But at the same time, there are reasons for optimism and hope. And it's always important to remember that, especially at a time like this. And we have won concessions out of the government. As I said, there have been significant U-turns around policy. And we also have the possibility, and I wouldn't put it any stronger than that, and I should add that I'm not a member of any political organisation, but we have the possibility of a genuinely progressive housing policy in this country in the form of a Jeremy Corbyn government. Now, I'm not talking about that in respect to Jeremy Corbyn as an individual, but I do know that he is someone who is absolutely unequivocal in his support for council housing in particular and a more humane housing policy in general. And there is a battle going on within the Labour Party and without it at the moment around this kind of crossroads, these opposite directions of travel, if you will. And it's a battle, and it's happening now, and we can all play our part. And so, again, I'd encourage you to pick up some of the agitational literature that I brought with me, and it's at the back of the room. Come along on Saturday, get involved in this campaign, because now, more than ever, for all of the reasons that Raquel has spelt out, we need a united national campaign to demand decent, secure and safe and truly affordable homes for all. Thanks very much.
Great, thank you. Those are two difficult acts to follow. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Raquel, for this exceptionally incisive book that we are here to launch. Since this is a book launch, I just want to start by mentioning a few things about this book that I really appreciate. First of all, as Glenn mentioned, it is global in scope, and it's truly global in scope. I mean, if you spend a lot of time in housing studies, you learn a lot about London, New York, and Berlin. This book is telling us not only about Brazil, which Raquel knows intimately, not only about famous housing disasters such as Spain and Ireland, not only about famous cases in the pantheon of neoliberalism such as Chile and the UK, but also places like Kazakhstan, Cambodia, and the Maldives that are really generally off the radar of urban scholars and housing scholars. And I appreciate that it is clearly describing the housing system as an actually global system, a planet-spanning phenomenon with emergent global qualities, but also irreducible local distinctiveness, and we get a very clear sense of that in this book. Secondly, I really appreciate the moments of first-person reportage here. It's clear from reading the book that Raquel has seen and experienced financialized housing at ground level. So we're taken to places like Astana and Rio, where we read first-person accounts of housing injustice as well as housing activism. And so this gives this book a concrete quality that helps us understand the consequences of the transformation of housing. It is something, these changes, they're deeply concrete, but they operate through unseen pressures and imperatives. And at times, the transformation of the housing system has the character of the violence of abstraction, but this book brings it back down to the communities and households that it is affecting, and it's very powerful for that reason. And finally, this is an appropriately deeply political book. I mean, it's about an inescapably political issue, and it is a deeply political book, and it makes its political argument in an extremely careful and systematic way. As we've sort of been discussing, there's a lot of interest in housing issues these days because everyone's living the housing problem. It's not a specialist concern. It's a broad condition. And so a lot of people are writing about housing, and it's quite easy to sort of veer off, I think, in two directions that are less than helpful. One of them, there's the sort of risk of dry, technocratic policy analysis that saps all of the politics out of the issue of housing. On the other hand, there's also a risk of sentimental polemics, which reduce housing to a purely moral issue. And what I really appreciate about this book is that it succeeds in pinpointing the injustice of housing today, but explaining the ideological and economic reasons why we have the housing problems that we have. So I think this is a truly useful contribution in that regard. So I want to use this book and Raquel and Glenn's comments as a starting point to highlight a few issues that I think emerge from this book and summarize and typify our current residential condition, and also raise some points, some questions to prompt further comment from Raquel and from Glenn and from the rest of the members of the audience as well, because it will be great to hear from all of you. So first, this book is structured around a very powerful image, and that image is the empire of finance. So Raquel writes, for example, on page 16 that, quote, "We live under the empire of finance and fictitious capital hegemony, an era of increasing dominance of rent extraction over productive capital." So this image of finance as this colonial force. On 280, she says, "The colonization of urban land and housing by finance is a powerful global process that even after a crisis such as that in 2008, survives and recreates itself as a hegemonic movement, putting down roots and penetrating into various environments." So we're given this strong description of finance as a neo-colonial project. It operates through integrating various territories, various relations, various different forms of states, various tenures, integrates them into this sprawling, uneven system. And I think it's a powerful metaphor because it highlights the scale of financialization and flags it as the essentially political problem that it is. So it would be great if we could talk a bit more about this image of the empire of finance. I would like to hear from Raquel more about the trappings of empire, its ruling ideologies, how it incorporates local elites into its project, as well as the sort of globally circulating high net worth individuals that we read so much about, even if we never really see. Do you think that decolonization is a useful way to think through the political response to this project? What should post-colonial housing look like? I mean, how far can we push this image of the empire of finance? Secondly, and continuing in this vein, it is clear that financialization is a profound challenge for national and urban governments. The state is always quite an ambivalent, ambiguous actor in all this. Is on the one hand an agent in financialization. I mean, the book is extremely clear that all the trappings of financialization are supported by the state in every step along the way. The expansion of the mortgage system, demand-side subsidies, microfinance, the financialization of informal housing, none of this could take place without the state's active intervention to support it. But on the other hand, we do see that states are complicated, contradictory things. They are they're battlegrounds themselves. The state at one level can pursue policies that conflicts with the state at the other level. And we see with financialization that the state is actually undercutting its ability to deviate from the financialized path. So how can we make sense of this process? And how can we make sense of the state's ability to even respond to financialization? I mean, Raquel mentioned the private equity firm Blackstone. Blackstone boasts that it controls $136 billion worth of assets around the globe, which is astounding. There's never been a landlord like that before in history. It is the largest owner of real estate in the U.S. It's the largest owner of real estate in Spain. It is moving into the U.K. market, by the way, and it claims to be the largest controller of real estate in the world. Once companies on this scale are established within housing systems, it is very hard for states to resist their influence. I mean, according to the U.S.-based Center for Responsive Politics, last year Blackstone had a lobbying budget in the U.S. alone of more than $2 million. And in 2008, they spent nearly $9 million lobbying the U.S. government in various issues. So how can states respond to powers like this? Housing reformers within states are outspent. They're outgunned. Local authorities, as you were saying, are not able to compete for land with entities like this. I mean, we should talk about how the state, even if it were the state to choose to stop making the problem worse, how much scope for action would it really have? And do you think there are any scales that provide greater strategic opportunities? Third, and similarly, financialization is clearly a profound political challenge for housing movements. Raquel details the crucial work of housing activists in Brazil, in Spain, and elsewhere across the globe. But it is clear from looking at this picture of financialization that housing movements are fighting a very difficult battle. And just for a moment, let's think comparatively about how struggles within residential capitalism worked 100 years ago. So here's a quote from the housing scholar Ronald Lawson, who's describing the first mass rent strike in New York City in 1904. This involves 2,000 tenants in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. So Lawson writes that the rent strikers, quote, placed considerable pressure on their landlords. Court fees and mover's charges made the securing of evictions costly, especially since the umbrella neighborhood tenant organization, the New York Rent Protective Association, used a lawyer to contest cases on technical grounds in the hope of tying them up and obtaining adjournments. This raised the specter of the loss of rent, which became more serious when tenants picketed their buildings to discourage applications from prospective tenants. Consequently, many landlords resolved the problems with their rent strikers. Close quote. So, I mean, all of these tactics represented real advances in housing politics. And the tenant unions, in essence, were able to mobilize in order to leverage power that put serious economic and organizational pressure on landlords with whom they could then meet face-to-face and negotiate. It was not a fair fight, but it was a fight in which the two sides were not completely outmatched. Compare this picture with a global landlord that controls $136 billion worth of assets. There's global conglomerates like that cannot be pressured by rent withholding. They're capitalized at orders of magnitude beyond that even the most well-organized local rent strike could possibly mobilize. They're not intimidated by the legal tactics of a lawyer who will tie them up in court because they shape and evade regulation at much higher scales. The challenge that housing movements are facing now has been radically transformed by the rescaling of real estate capital. And so we need to talk about how housing movements might possibly be able to gain a foothold in deeply financialized and swiftly financializing housing systems. It's not to say that they're not trying. Raquel argues on 264 that in Brazil, a new coalition of social movements is starting to come together in which the right to the city is definitely at the heart of the agenda. She writes on 278 that the paradox of neoliberal economic globalization is precisely that it simultaneously weakens and rouses the social forces of resistance. So let's talk a bit about how this resistance might actually make an impact in the conditions that we're describing. And fourth and finally, I invite us all to reflect on the title of this book, Urban Warfare, where the city and the housing system is portrayed as a battleground. The weapons, it seems clear, are debt and rent. The theater of conflict are the cities and hinterlands, the built and unbuilt environments across the world, which, as you say, are also the objects of struggle. If you walk around London or New York or similar cities, or really any big city across the world, it's not hard to see it as a battleground with demolished and half-demolished landscapes of social housing sitting alongside the rising citadels that are being created by global elites. I think we need to face the fact that urban warfare that the book describes is really everyday life for a lot of households. And as much as there's a sort of variety of different conflicts pulled in here, I think we can see that this is really a reflection of growing inequality, a reflection of a newly predatory relationship between elites and working people and poor people. This is a sort of variety of class conflict. And in sort of classic class conflict fashion, we see the state is being drawn in as a tool in this struggle. We see this sort of broader picture of deep social conflict being worked out in the residential system. And that's why superficial small changes to housing policy are never going to solve the housing problem. So I invite Raquel to tell us more about this very powerful image of urban warfare that she's conjured. And I invite everyone from the audience as well to tell us stories from the front line. So thank you again for this great book. I'm going to leave it there. And yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm conscious that we have a fantastic room full of energy and expertise, but I wonder if you could bear with me while I ask Raquel maybe just to take a couple of minutes to respond to David's questions largely around the analytic of this immense empire and what to do. And then it would be great to just open up to the floor. When I open up, if you have a question, please tell us who you are and where you come from, and then proceed with the question. Thank you.
To tell the truth, the idea of an empire came in the last minute of the writing of the book. I was not thinking at all on this metaphor of empire. And I was not, by the time, familiar with all the literature on colonial, post-colonial thinking. And it was in the last 2 days before I was submitting the book that I came an image into my mind. Yes, This is an empire. I mean, more than an empire. This is a process of colonization. And it was very nice. Then, because of that, I started to work with all the colonial, post-colonial studies of Jenny Robinson work and more people. Because I think that it's a wonderful framework to rethink completely the way we deal with our cities and housing and etc. Why that? Because, and then I will respond in one only reply to your both questions. We basically see all the self-built settlements around the world, all the squatter land, all the way people have created their ways of life and their emplacements as a failure of urban planning, as a failure of the state. But if we reverse completely the way we can see that, yes, there is material precarity. Yes, absolutely. And it's outrageous. I'm not defending here that this is the place to go and the way to organize space. But there is material deprivation and material precarity because there is no money circulating there, basically. No private money and no investment at all from the part of the states or the capture of the wealth. So why I'm saying that? Because I think that in this battle, any space being a social, a council housing in UK, being a urbanized favela in São Paulo, which is not organized through the weapons of debt and rent and rent-seeking landscape, is a very important territory that shields people and the place from the attack of financialization. So having said that, I think, of course, the way to go, it's not just a question of upscaling and seeing as a global. It's important not to paralyze us. Instead, oh, my God, what can I do? It's something that it's beyond the power of my own country or my own government. It's not at all. But at the same time, it's important to see that if it is a global process, if it is a global phenomenon with particular ways, in each locality, it's very important to invest and nurture and promote the de-mercantilization of land and housing, being those very, very different solutions. And I'm seeing this movement going on. It's an everyday battle of every place, which instead of being lived as a failure, a residual, should be lived as an outpost for defending other ways of relating people with territories, with other values, and other ways of relating people one to the others, means based on community bonds. So I could bring here several examples that are being tried both by social movements and some eventually local policies at city level that are trying to do that. And I think this is very important because this is creating also an example and a belief that something very different is possible, and creating a new reference to ourselves. Because what we have when we go from city to city is that, no, there is just one way to go, one solution, and this is absolutely not true. So just referring, community land trusts, cooperatives, self-built squatter housing, regulating rent, unions, tenants, organizations and strike, staying put, stopping demolitions and refurbishing. All of that is part of this battle, and it's not, and I think this is a crucial difference from, and thank you, David, for bringing the history of housing struggles. And I think there is one big difference between the battles of the past of 20th century and the battles of 21st century. The battles of 20th century were battles that people used to write down an agenda in order to seize power and then implement the agenda. The battles of 21st century are basically fought on the ground level, where people are simply doing and transforming and creating and generating and resisting of what they have been done, without really imagining that the states are capable to bring all these reforms and all the changes. We have seen states today are not capable to do that, but we are.
Fantastic. Who would like to start with questions? Sylvia, I'll take two questions at a time. Sylvia and the person at the back.
Hello, Raquel. It's nice to see you again. During the last time, it was the World Urban Forum in Naples in 2012, when you were a UN Special Rapporteur, you were a passionate advocate of women's housing rights and the importance of housing rights for women. And I just wonder whether you could, I haven't quite looked through the whole index yet, but I have a copy of the book and I'm looking forward to reading it. I just wondered how you see gender featuring in this kind of intensified phase of housing mercantilisation.
Thanks, Sylvia. One more question.
Hi, my name is Sophie Worrell. I work in the public sector. So my question is on the matter of gentrification. And so I'm a relatively new Londoner and deciding where to live, sort of face some moral qualms of where to live. And I think there's an interesting matter of what do-gooders can do on that micro level, whilst I also felt you're being a pawn in the bigger game of this empire of finance which you described. So it's a bit of a question, both thoughts about gentrification, but also how do we combat it?
Let's have a few more.
Hi, my name is Meghna, and I'm a student at the Cities Program. My question is, in a lot of cultures, including the one I come from in India, owning a house is almost like an aspiration, especially for people who move up the ladder of poverty. So what do you do in a situation like that, where there is a lot of political motivation based on the cultural needs of the people?
Okay, let's take a few more. Right at the back then.
You want to say something?
There's one more.
this one more.
In short, what are your thoughts on the 1930s private housing boom in construction in the UK?
Okay, so let's.
Let's take Jenny and then Buster Kuzi just for a little bit of response.
I guess I'm interested in the conundrum of this whole story, which is the local global. So you say it's globalized, but then it's differentiated. So how do you think about that? So the one line is the finance is itself differentiated. So it's not a border finance, many different ways of securing housing finance, and it makes quite a difference. So, for example, and then the second thing is the difference of the locality and the way in which value is organized, the way in which state structures function. So how does it come together in London is ironically built to rent becomes the most financialized format and perhaps the best one for housing solutions. So that's the property state. So I think we've got quite a long way to go to kind of unpack those two kinds of differences. And I think you've given us a rousing reason for doing that.
Thank you. Oof. First of all, when I'm doing a critique as home ownership through credit as the one and only solution, I am certainly not arguing against any forms of home ownership to credit. I think this is a solution for some situations, some people in some places, and maybe it's a good one. The problem is when this is transformed into the only one and being pushed in the direction of people that, one, don't want. So I loved a manifesto that I read the other day. I can't remember the name of their author, which was The Right Not to Buy. It's perfect. I can have the right to access adequate housing without being obliged to get a credit and be a slave to a bank at the rest of my life and still have access to adequate housing. So the idea of having several solutions, different solutions to different housing needs, to different housing conditions, I think it's very important. So I'm not battling for a completely different system in which home ownership will disappear from the earth. No, I think it's part of the machinery and can be. And the problem is not the home ownership, but is the link between the machinery of promoting home ownership with the machinery of financialization. So let's cut this umbilical cord. That's what I'm saying. It's the opposite of what has been done. Instead, so there is a lot of schemes like community credit and cooperative community banks. There is a lot of way of mobilizing money because, of course, in order to build houses, we need money. It's expensive. It's not like a cloth that you can buy. It's something that is expensive. But there are many other ways of doing that, and especially, I mean, we don't really need to have this as a property ownership. But coming into that, there is a very deep thing, and I won't have any time to develop that, and it's developed a little in the second part of the book, which is the very important link between property, citizenship, and the way our democracies, our liberal democracies, were shaped. So we are talking about something which is very deep, and it's a very important foundation of a certain specific ways of organizing states that, guess what? We don't need to organize all the territories and all the societies like that. So this is a much more broader thinking on the crisis that we are living, because we are living a crisis also of the so-called democratic liberal state. Where is this democratic liberal state is leading us? So I think there is also a connection between the two. Second, the question of women's, I think that part of the coloniality of the model includes a very patriarchal, male-oriented way of organizing space. And I think taking that from a women's or a gender point of view is also a way of unpacking and detangling the whole package that was sold to us as the ideal way of organizing cities and houses, and thinking that in another way. I think it's a very interesting path, which I have not done in this work, but I think it's definitely a way to go. On gentrification, I did not use the word gentrification, and I don't use this word because, I mean, it's a very nice word everybody's using. But, I mean, I think gentrification does not really help us to conceptually explain what is going on. So it's much more complex what is going on, this taking over of our communities, the changes in our ways of organizing life. So I think that this is one concept fits all. This process does really not help us. And I think not everything that is happening in terms of changes in our city, it is directly related to the expansion of the real estate financial complex, of course. There are other, I mean, prosperities in communities is something very good. Communities must change and prosper. And sometimes this is a good thing. So we are talking about overall process with huge inequalities and huge imbalances that I think that should be combated. Then what should I do as the Minister of Housing? Well, if I were the Minister of Housing of the planet, which is a wonderful mandate to have. No, I'm kidding. But as a Minister of Housing, I think that especially thinking and hearing from the people where I'm hearing here, one of the strategies of UK government has been announcing over and over the need to build more houses. And the need to be more houses, including releasing land because of from the planning restrictions, and especially using public land in order to do that, to provide more houses. So I think one of the issues, key issues, it is public land. And I can bring the example of Uruguay and Uruguayan and Montevideo housing policy, which is an example up until today of using public land, refurbished public land, in order to provide space for non-financialized housing. Means cooperatives, community, land trust, council housing. So that is what public land is meant for, and not to make money or make profit. So using the public land to do that, then, of course, you won't solve the whole thing. There is no magic wand. But at least you support and create and promote a sector that will be larger and larger and provide accommodation for more people. Second thing, I think it's very important, especially in some cities, to introduce rent regulations. And I'm not talking about any communist measure. I'm talking about measures that were adopted by New York, by Berlin, and cities in the capitalist world, which at that time were effective. And of course, using the experience critically of what happened in those in those places, we can perfectionate the mechanisms of rent caps and rent regulations. So I think those also are, it's very important. And it's very important, something that is being done, it's been proposed, and will be a referendum in Berlin on that, is to just forbid the existence of landlords with more than X hundreds of houses. I mean, we are in the position to do that and say no. No, more than, okay, for our aunt or ourselves renting one house is okay, but a landlord with 82,000 homes in one city is outrageous. So I think it's absolutely possible to block that, to impede that, and knowing that most of and I'm going back to the comment David made, most of these investment funds that became big, big landlords and players, they are doing so with a lot of incentives. For instance, real estate investment trusts don't pay taxes. And our poor aunt that rent out one apartment pay a lot of taxes on that. So we should just stop that and tax a lot real estate investment trusts instead of just exempting. So I think there is a lot of things that can be done immediately without breaking or destroying the state the way it is or the cities the way they are.
Glenn, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I very quickly, I mean, on the gender question, I refer to some of the successful housing campaigns that we've had recently that I've had the pleasure of being involved in, and part, a major part of the reason that they have been successful, in my opinion, is that they have had large-scale involvement of and leadership by women, and of the obvious reason for that is that oftentimes it's women who are on the at the sharp end, at the receiving end of the attacks on secure housing and from the so-called austerity agenda. And just quickly on Jenny's point and the gentrification question, I mean, a bit like Raquel, I tend not to use the word anymore. It seems to be of diminishing usefulness to me. And I say that as somebody who lives in Bethnal Green, incidentally, which is the kind of epicenter of gentrification at the moment, or so-called gentrification. But I know some of those people, and when I talk to them and when I see the private renters living on the estate where I work, you know, to oversimplify it somewhat, they are not members of the gentry. So I don't see this as a process of gentrification at all. Oftentimes they are, as I said earlier, super exploited by the conditions in the private rented sector. But I think another aspect to this is that we, and it refers to what you, I think, were asking, I think it's really important that we don't individualise what is a global problem, and not take it personally. I mean, yes, we're all responsible for our own choices in life generally and housing included, but I think it is a critical part of the ideological warfare. Mm-hmm. And we talk about privatisation of housing, and privatisation has more than one meaning. And I think, you know, the neoliberal project explicitly wants us to privatise our thinking as well as our actions around housing. So I would say if the question is, can I go and live in Bethnal Green, yes, you are welcome to come and join us in Bethnal Green, it's fine. And just finally on Tim, I mean, yeah, Raquel's mentioned the use of public lands, absolutely essential. New Economics Foundation estimate the potential for at least 200,000, and I think they should be council homes, 200,000 council homes that could be built on the acres of public land that are unused in this country. Some students at the LSC that I've had the pleasure of working with this year, we've done a case study on the Holloway prison site, which people might be aware of. It's been in the news recently. Again, a huge opportunity, and one that I fear is about to be squandered for reasons that we don't have time to go into. But that site, which is public land, had the potential for, again, up to 1,000 council homes. And I'm not saying that every home that is built from now on needs to be a council home. That isn't the argument. The point is that we need a more balanced approach to housing policy in this country. And that obviously would include empty homes. Mm-hmm. Obviously, estimates vary, but at any time there may be between 300,000 and 1 million homes standing empty for 6 months or more. And Tim, you know, I'm not having a pop at you. I used to work for a housing association as well. But we have to restore housing associations to their original social purpose. And it isn't just that we're not building enough homes. We're not building enough of the right type of homes. And I'm afraid housing associations have become not so much part of the solution, but part of the problem, because they are building more homes for the private market now, and often in many situations, than they are for social rent. And that is something that has to change. And my view on that would be very simple. If and when I do become Minister of Housing, and let's face it, it can't be far off. You know, until housing associations do cop onto themselves and remember what they're supposed to be doing and who they're supposed to be serving, yeah, they should not get another penny of public money.